Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Hello, and welcome to another adventure in history. We're so happy you're joining us. And happy, nice little stretch of dry weather.
So how was Mother's Day?
It was great. I woke up at 6 a.m. to a child that wanted to wake up. And I got to do all the things I wanted to do for the day.
Now, do they feel the need to make you breakfast and you have to like pretend to like the burnt toast and the...
No, my kids
mushy pancakes or something.
Into cooking, but I did force them to go out to brunch, which they weren't exactly thrilled with.
Really?
No. But I got some really cute little things.
And yet
I
mean, your kids like going to like tea and scones, steamed plum pudding. I would think they would like the idea of brunch.
Yeah, not their thing. I should have done the Mother's Day brunch at the Flavel house, but I didn't.
Well, it was
next
the day before.
I know.
Tea and scones. It was wonderful.
But it's still for Mother's Day.
That's
right?
True.
Yeah.
The day before Mother's Day.
Yeah. What'd you do?
We went out to eat, and my daughter came down, and we went to Sunday Market.
Nice. Opening day.
Opening
day. Gorgeous. That's always really nice for all those vendors. It's a long day.
You know, what I'm curious on is Mother's Day the busiest day of their season? And are people actually buying, or are they, mom will like this, let's walk through Sunday Market on Mother's Day?
Probably a little bit of both, but I would definitely think that the flower vendors do amazing.
And I'm also curious, I wonder if the downtown businesses benefit or not.
I'm not going to speculate.
Yeah, I don't know. I could see it going either way.
Yeah, that's
because
true.
Tons of people downtown, so yes, overkill, but I could also see, we're just going to the Sunday Market and then we're going home.
Right.
I could see it going either way.
It could.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Things to plug. Memorial Day weekend on Saturday, May 25th, we have the Lublin Festival on the grounds of the Flavel House, our friends at Fort George Brewery. What I really like about this, they did it once, and for some reason, I'm not really sure, just they had access to it. They have a big, giant, inflatable T-Rex.
I love that.
And when they asked if they could do it again, like the second or third year, I said, and I was just goofing around. I was like, as long as you bring the T-Rex. So now they always bring the giant T-Rex. And it makes me laugh that he's just on the side lawn of the Flavel House, and the photo ops are just kind of funny. Oh,
so tell me about this festival, though. Is it free? Do I have to pay?
Oh, it's a Fort George thing.
Okay.
Tickets are probably already sold out.
Oh, okay. but if not, we would go to the Fort George website.
But they give us a portion of the ticket sales.
Yeah. Oh, so I love that.
So technically, it's kind of a fundraiser for us.
Sure. Well, it's a nice venue.
Whether you want to call it a fundraiser or not, regardless, the Historical Society makes some money on it.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's a good
deal.
That. And it's people that probably have never come to the Flavel House before.
And it's inside and outside?
Or just outside? They are allowed inside, but they have to check their beer outside.
That makes sense.
Yes. But the T-Rex just always makes me laugh. All right. And then Goonies Day, June 7th, 8th,
up.
And 9th. And check out to see the schedule and things. But we know we've got Mick Alderman is doing 3 weeks with the Goonies at 1:30 because he was a young film student and he was allowed to shadow the director, Richard Donner.
I love it.
And then he wrote a book.
Good.
I can't remember if we've had him. We have had him on the show quite a while ago.
I don't remember meeting him.
And then with the Astoria Parks Department, their movies in the park.
Perfect.
They're going to show the Goonies on the backyard of the Flavel House.
I like that.
Yeah. So it's going to be fun. And then, of course, the Oregonian Challenge. You can become an Oregonian.
Oregonian. Okay.
39 suggested activities. If you do like half of them, you come back, you get the commemorative pin.
Think we could ever set up the zip line?
Well, they did.
They did?
Yeah. The owner of the Goonies house did it last year.
They did.
Yeah.
Last year. Oh, I missed that.
Where have you been? Living under a rock.
I know. And did he let people do it?
No. He had like a little, like 2/3 size data doll.
Oh, jeez. No, like a real one.
Yeah.
I mean, that'd be fun.
Insurance.
Okay. All right.
Or are you just trying to get more customers for Providence Seaside?
Right. Exactly. They might stop at another hospital along the way.
All right. What do we got? A word?
I got a word. Okay. Smatchet.
Smatchet.
And it's a noun. It's a person, place, or a thing. Smatchet.
A smatchet is a small portion of firewood.
Hmm. Nope. It's an ill-mannered, despicable person.
Ooh.
Don't be a smatchet.
A smatchet. That sounds like something out of Dr. Seuss.
I like this one. So this one I think I could use again.
A smatchet.
Yeah. You're being a smatchet. So watch out.
Oh, and you could use it in public as code. Yeah. Nobody would know but your kids.
I mean, like, use my mom voice, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I like that.
So if you hear me say that, and my kid's looking at me strangely, or saying it back to me is more likely, you're being a smatchet, Mom.
Oh, no. So you need to make them aware of the word, and that way you can use it in public.
Yes.
And everybody be like, what? All right. So the big history highlights, May 20th. Tomorrow, of course, 1498.
Okay, going back.
Vasco da Gama reaches India. First European via ship.
Okay.
So, would you ever want to go to India?
Yes.
Do you really?
Oh, yes.
Interesting. Okay.
But I would want to go with somebody who has ties to India. Like their fan.
Knows their way ancestry, around and sure. speaks and mm-hmm. is already familiar and has already been where you're going.
Yes.
Knows where to take
you. I wouldn't want to be just a tourist. Yes. Tourist. Yes. Yeah.
1506, Christopher Columbus dies. 1774, King George III, or III, as I call him, approves the coercive acts in response to the Boston Tea Party.
Ooh.
1774, pushing us. You keep pushing us.
No, it didn't go well. Yeah.
1830, and I was almost going to make you guess the year, but I've already said the year. D. Hyde patents the fountain pen.
Oh, 1830. Okay.
I was tempted to make that the history highlight.
That's a big
one. The fountain pen.
Yeah.
Now, do you always carry a pen?
I do.
I always have a pen as well.
Yes.
I don't understand people that don't always have a pen handy. All right. 1862, President Lincoln signs the Homestead Act. All you have to do is go west. You get 160 acres as long as you build a building on it, a home,
right,
and farm it. It's yours. After 5 years, it's yours.
It's yours unless it was yours originally, right? I mean, because the Native Americans did own the property first.
Yes, but the government took it.
I know.
So
yes. But yes, Homestead Act. Okay.
Yeah. Homestead Act. It was also a big one. Always.
It was, yeah, very influential.
Go west, young man. All right, 1891. The first public display of Thomas Edison's prototype kinetoscope to members of the National Federation of Women's Club.
Oh.
He shows movies to the women first.
Okay, the purse holders. There we go.
Isn't that exciting? 1891. Mm-hmm. 1892, George Sampson patents the clothes dryer.
Well, I can appreciate that.
And I wanted to look this one up because it would laugh to me. It would make me laugh if it was just clothespins and a rope.
Oh.
But I think that year it's a real dryer.
Probably is a motor. Probably was not that efficient, but still.
1927, Charles Lindbergh takes off across the Atlantic in the Spirit of St. Louis.
Yeah.
Have you been to Smithsonian? The Air and Space Museum? Have you seen it?
I have not.
It's very unimpressive.
Is it very small? Or
yeah,
is it...
just because it is such an important part of aviation history, you just want it to be something grand and amazing and huge and beautiful and wonderful. And
it's not.
It's the Spirit of St. Louis.
Okay.
Okay. We might talk a little bit about that because I went down a rabbit hole.
Okay.
1959, Japanese Americans regain their citizenship.
Yes.
1959.
Took a while.
Now, we've talked about the Japanese-American internment camps. 1940s, and you heard me right, 1959, we give them their citizenship back.
Oh, man.
Sometimes we're a little slow to catch up. All right, and moving along, 1993, the final episode of Cheers airs on NBC.
Oh, I have been to the Cheers bar.
So have I.
Yeah.
I did not go inside. I just took a picture on the outside.
I think I looked inside. Outside is a much bigger bar. Mm-hmm. So we actually ate there, had a drink there with our closest friends.
So my question, you might have already answered this. Do we care?
Oh, no. I never watched the show.
I did not either. I've only watched it in reruns somewhat.
Yeah.
Interesting. I do like George Wendt. Norm! That always made me laugh.
I mean, they're all good actors.
Yeah. All right. 2015, We Do Care. David Letterman hosts The Late Show with David Letterman for the last time, ending 33 years in late night television.
Oh.
I love David Letterman. As a kid, as a young teenager, watching him on late night.
Yeah.
All right. But our history highlight of the day, thing I think had the most impact. 1873. Levi Strauss and Jacob Davis receive a patent for blue jeans with copper rivets.
I was wondering if you'd mention this.
Blue jeans.
I like that. That's a good one.
They changed the world.
They did. Yeah. I'm wearing blue jeans right now. I love it.
Do they have rivets?
Don't they all?
I don't know.
Isn't that like seam? Is that the rivet, the seam, or is it the button?
Or is that the only Levi Strauss did the rivet and nobody else did? Did everybody infringe on their patent if they're using them?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, well, they're very effective use of effective to wear.
America's pants, and they beat communism.
There we go.
Because all the people living in communist worlds want blue jeans and Beatles tapes.
Blue jeans, yeah.
And maybe cola.
There we go. Right.
All right. Did I miss anything?
You didn't. That was the one that I was waiting for. But well,
you were waiting, and I ruined.
Waiting.
Your...
Yeah.
Okay. So the rabbit. This is a rabbit hole show.
I like the rabbit hole shows. Yeah.
Because sometimes we'll chat, and we have no guests, and if there's a logical holiday or something we want to do a deeper dive on, frequently you come up with the program.
Yeah.
And if there's nothing really to speak of, then I come up with the program. And when I saw Charles Lindbergh, I remembered reading somewhere about 1911, our Astoria centennial celebration. And see, that might be when I was researching before the Astoria bicentennial. So I'm not sure where I saw this.
Somewhere.
But during either the regatta or just part of the centennial celebration in 1911, Astorians and Clatsop Countyans went nuts because we had Curtis and his amazing hydro aeroplane.
Exciting.
He basically invented the seaplane, the ship, the planes that can land in the water and take off again. So I went to our handy dandy online internet archive, looking through our old cumtuxes, and all I could find were four pictures.
So you had the pictures, though.
So we had the pictures. And then I did a deeper dive, and I'm looking through all of the bicentennial things, thinking, well, maybe it was there. Maybe I used to have the little 30-second radio spots of this day in history. Maybe that's where I remember it from. Absolutely could not find anything in any of our Classic Canadian Historical Society collections. And probably our curator or archivist are going to hear this. They're going to be like, Mac, you idiot. It's right here. We have a whole file on it. But I could not find anything in our scanned digitization.
Right.
So maybe if I just come over to the archives and gone through. But in my online researching, I learned more about this Curtis guy, and he's kind of amazing.
Okay.
So I thought we would talk a little bit about Curtis and why we all really should know him as much as the Wright brothers.
Well, let's learn.
So do you want to start?
Sure. The first successful flight of what was originally called a hydro aeroplane, or simply hydro, but is now known as a seaplane, was made on the 26th of January in 1911. It used a clumsy tandem float arrangement featuring a main float about 1.82 meters wide by 1.52 meters long under a center section, a smaller float forward, and a hydrofoil ahead of that to keep the bow from submerging at high speed. The wide design of the main float served two purposes. By being wide, it was expected to function as an auxiliary wing to generate useful lift. Also, its width would keep the spray pattern well outboard of the pusher propeller. Being short, it did not provide longitudinal stability on the water, thus necessitating the forward float. By the 1st of February, a new arrangement was introduced comprising a sledge-shaped single float. Now, this one was 3.65 meters long, 0.6 meters wide, and 3.3 meters deep under the pilot and engine to provide longitudinal stability. Small floats for lateral stability were under the wingtips. Now, at first, the main float was not compartmented. On a flight at Hammond's Port, Curtis took off in a hydro, but a considerable amount of water had got into the float, and he nosed down to a light.
I can picture it.
All the water ran to the bow of the float and made the machine so nose-heavy that he was unable to raise the nose and crashed into the lake. He recognized the problem as soon as it appeared, and fortunately, he survived to correct it. An early refinement of the hydro was to eliminate the booms that supported the forward elevator and place a monoplane elevator on the bow of the float. As on contemporary land planes, the hydro's forward elevators were soon eliminated.
So he's up in basically the Finger Lakes of New York.
Okay.
And doing this. And this is where I found that first. And then I was like, oh my gosh, I want to learn more about this guy. So Glenn Hammond Curtis, he lived from 1878 through 1930, so didn't live a terribly long life, was an American aviation and motorcycling pioneer and a founder of the U.S. aircraft industry. He began his career as a bicycle racer and builder before moving on to motorcycles. As early as 1904, he began to manufacture engines for airships. In 1908, Curtis joined the Aerial Experiment Association, a pioneering research group founded by Alexander Graham Bell in Nova Scotia to build flying machines. Exciting. What a time period. These guys are all just tinkering and making these flying machines.
Yeah, it's what little kids dream of, right?
Yeah. Curtis won a race as the world's first international at the world's first international air meet in France and made the first long-distance flight in the U.S.
The first?
Yes.
The first.
Oh, there's to sit on the edge of your seat, Missy, because there's a lot more coming.
Okay.
His contributions in designing and building aircraft led to the formation of the Curtis Airplane and Motor Company, which later merged into the Curtis Wright Brothers Corporation. His company built aircraft for the U.S. Army and Navy, and during the years leading up to World War I, his experiments with seaplanes led to advances in naval aviation. Curtis's civil and military aircraft were some of the most important types in the interwar and World War II eras. So his early career... Glenn Curtis was born in 1878 in Hammondsport, New York, situated on the southern tip of Keka Lake, one of the Finger Lakes in New York. His mother was Lua Curtis, née Andrews, and his father was Frank Richmond Curtis, a harness maker, who had arrived in Hammondsport with Glenn's grandparents in 1876. His paternal grandparents were as a Methodist Episcopal clergyman, and his mom. And then Glenn Curtis had a younger sister, Rutha Luella, also born in Hammondsport.
Okay. Although his formal education extended only to eighth grade, his early interest in mechanics and inventions was evident at his first job at the Eastman Dry Plate and Film Company, later Eastman Kodak Company in Rochester, New York. His job at the factory was to stencil numbers on the paper backing of the film manufactured by the company. He figured out how to speed up the process of stenciling and built a stencil machine, a rack with a brush on a hinge that would stencil 100 paper strips with a single stroke of the brush. This improved his thought. Output 10 times, and eventually the company adopted his invention.
Isn't that a crack up? Okay, we want you to like just stencil on the back of this paper, and he figures out a way to do 100 of them at a time instead of one at a time.
And also he invented something and got no money or credit for it. I mean, he got credit for it, but he also built a rudimentary camera to study photography. He began his career as a Western Union bicycle messenger, a bicycle racer, and a bicycle shop owner. In 1901, he developed an interest in motorcycles when internal combustion engines became more available. In 1902, Curtis began manufacturing motorcycles with his own single-cylinder engines. His first motorcycle's carburetor was adapted from a tomato soup can containing a gauze screen to pull the gasoline up by capillary action. In 1903, he set a motorcycle land speed record at 64 miles per hour for 1 mile. When E.H. Corson of the Hendy Manufacturing Company, manufacturers of Indian motorcycles, visited.
So the people that like love Harley Davidsons, Indian motorcycle was like the very beginning of the motorcycle industry.
Oh.
And a lot of the guys that love historic motorcycles will just talk about the Indians. Were just amazing.
Interesting. So when they visited Hammondsport in July of 1904, he was amazed that the entire Curtis Motorcycle Enterprise was located in the back room of the modest shop. Corson's motorcycles had just been trounced the week before by hell rider Curtis in an endurance race from New York to Cambridge, Maryland. And on January 24th, 1907, Curtis set an unofficial world record of 136.36 miles per hour on a 40-horsepower V8-powered motorcycle of his own design and construction in Ormond Beach, Florida. The air-cooled F-head engine was intended for use in aircraft, and he remained the fastest man in the world, the title newspapers gave him, until 1911, and his motorcycle record was not broken until 1930. This motorcycle is now in the Smithsonian Institution. Curtis's success at racing strengthened his reputation as a leading maker of high-performance motorcycles and engines.
So I think that was the paragraph that made me think, okay, as much as I was going down a rabbit hole and there's like just a small link to Astoria and Clatsop County, I wanted to learn more about this guy.
This guy is amazing.
He's the fastest man in the world on his right. motorcycle. He's got basically an airplane motor on his motorcycle.
With an eighth grade education.
Yeah. Making it a little in a tool shed out back kind of deal. Doesn't he just sound amazing
and
already?
And he helped Kodak out just a little bit.
Yeah. In 1904, Curtis became a supplier of engines for the California aeronaut Tom Baldwin, who inspired Curtis to pursue aviation in that same year. Baldwin's California Aero, powered by a Curtis 9 HP V-twin motorcycle engine, became the first successful dirigible in America. In 1907, Alexander Graham Bell invited Curtis to develop a suitable engine for heavier-than-air flight experimentation. Bell regarded Curtis as the, quote, greatest motor expert in the country, and invited Curtis to join the Aerial Experiment Association.
So do AEA. I understand that then? So the first flight machine was powered by a motorcycle engine?
First dirigible.
Dirigible. Okay.
Yeah. So between 1908 and 1910, the AEA produced four aircraft, each one an improvement over the last. Curtis primarily designed the AEA's third aircraft, Aerodrome No. 3, the famous Junebug, and became its test pilot, undertaking most of the proving flights. On July 4th, 1908, he flew 5,080 feet to win the Scientific American Trophy.
Wow.
And its $2,500 prize in 1908. This is considered to be the first pre-announced public flight of a heavier-than-air flying machine in America.
Wow.
The flight of the Junebug propelled Curtis and aviation firmly into public awareness. On June 8, 1911, Curtis received U.S. Pilot's License No. 1 from the Aero Club of America because the first batch of licenses were issued in alphabetical order. Wilbur Wright received License No. 5. And I like that they talk about that it's the first publicized, pre-announced public flight, because right. the Wright brothers are just kind of unannounced going down to the beach and trying. And even though there are witnesses, they didn't publicly announce because they weren't positive it was going to work.
Right.
So Curtis and his crew are like, yeah, come watch this thing. It's going to work.
Because they know it's going to work. And then he wins. I mean, right? So
at the culmination of the Aerial Experiment Association's experiments, Curtis is offered to purchase the rights to Aerodrome No. 3, essentially using it as the basis of his Curtis No. 1, the first of his production series of pusher aircraft.
But after a 1909 fallout with the AEA, Curtis joined the A.M. Herring, backers from the Aero Club of America, to found the Herring Curtis Company in Hammondsport. During the 1909-1910 period, Curtis employed a number of demonstration pilots, including Eugene Ely, Charles K. Hamilton, J.A.D. McCurdy, Augustus Post, and Hugh Robinson. Aerial competitions and demonstration flights across North America helped to introduce aviation to a curious public. Curtis took full advantage of these occasions to promote his products. This was a busy period for Glenn Curtis. In August of 1909, Curtis took part in the Grand Semaine d'Aviation, an aviation meeting in France organized by the Aero Club of France. The Wrights, who were selling their machines to customers in Germany at the time, decided not to compete in person. Two Wright aircraft, modified with a landing gear, were at the meet, but they did not win any events. On August 28, 1909, flying his number 2 biplane, Curtis won the overall speed event, the Gordon Bennett Cup, completing the 12.5-mile course in under just 16 minutes at a speed of 46.5 miles per hour, 6 seconds faster than the runner-up.
He's beating the Wright brothers.
Who aren't even participating. On May 29th, 1910, Curtis flew from Albany to New York City to make the first long-distance flight between two major cities in the United States. The first. For this 137-mile flight, which he completed in just under 4 hours, including one stop to refuel, he won a $10,000 prize offered by publisher Joseph Pulitzer and was awarded permanent possession of the Scientific American Trophy.
In June 1910, Curtis provided a simulated bombing demonstration to naval officers at Hammondsport. 2 months later, Lieutenant Jacob E. Fickle demonstrated the feasibility of shooting at targets on the ground from an aircraft, with Curtis serving as pilot. 1 month later, in September, he trained Blanche Stewart Scott, who was possibly the first American woman pilot.
Cool.
The fictional character Tom Swift, for all of us old folks out there, who first appeared in 1910 in Tom Swift and his motorcycle and Tom Swift and his airship, has been said to have been based on Glenn Curtis. And I can see it because I read a few of those books as a kid. Huh. The Tom Swift books are set in a small town on a lake in upstate New York.
How interesting. Familiar?
So a patent lawsuit by the Wright brothers against Curtis in 1909 continued until it was resolved during World War I. Since the last Wright aircraft, the Wright Model L, was a single prototype of a scouting aircraft made in 1916, the U.S. government, desperately short of combat aircraft, pressured both firms to resolve the dispute. Of nine suits Wright brought against Curtis and others, and the three suits brought against them, the Wright brothers eventually won every case in courts in the United States.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. On November 14th, 1910, Curtis demonstration pilot Eugene Ely took off from a temporary platform mounted on the forward deck of the cruiser USS Birmingham. His successful takeoff and ensuing flight to shore marked the beginning of a relationship between Curtis and the Navy that remained significant for decades. At the end of 1910, Curtis established a winter encampment at San Diego to teach flying to Army and Naval personnel. Here, he trained Lieutenant Theodore Ellison, who became U.S. Naval Aviator 1, and three Army officers, First Lieutenant Paul W. Beck, Second Lieutenant George E. M. Kelly, and Second Lieutenant John C. Walker Jr. in his first military aviation school. The original site of this winter encampment is now part of the Naval Air Station North Island and is referred to by the Navy as the birthplace of naval aviation. Through the course of that winter, Curtis was able to develop a float pontoon design that enabled him to take off and land on water. On January 26, 1911, he flew the first seaplane from the water in the United States. Demonstrations of this advanced design were of great interest to the Navy, but more significant, as far as the Navy was concerned, was Eugene Ely successfully landing his Curtis Pusher, the same aircraft used to take off from the Birmingham, on a makeshift platform mounted on the rear deck of the battleship USS Pennsylvania. This was the first arrestor cable landing on a ship and the precursor of modern-day carrier operations. On January 28, 1911, Ellison took off in a Curtis grass cutter to become the first naval aviator.
So Curtis custom-built floats and adapted them onto a Model D so it could take off and land on water to prove the concept. On February 24, 1911, Curtis made his first amphibious demonstration at North Island by taking off and alighting on both land and water. Back in Hammondsport, 6 months later, in July 1911, Curtis sold the U.S. Navy their first aircraft, the A-1 Triad. The A-1, which was primarily a seaplane, was equipped with retractable wheels, also making it the first amphibious aircraft. Curtis trained the Navy's first pilots and built their first aircraft. For this, he is considered in the U.S. to be the father of naval aviation. Huh. The Triad was immediately recognized as so obviously useful. It was purchased by the U.S. Navy, Russia, Japan, Germany, and Britain. Curtis won the Collier Trophy for designing this aircraft.
Henry Kleckler, considered Curtis's right-hand man and a master innovator and mechanic, was also a native of Hammondsport and worked with Curtis in developing more efficient engines for the flying boats pioneered and developed by Curtis.
So he's, you know, this is just... He's in San Diego demonstrating this, and he sends his pilots and he up and down the coast, and that's why they must have been here in the summer of 1911.
Yeah.
Because they're showing this to the public and getting excitement.
The timeline works, Mac. You went down a rabbit hole, but it seems like you landed correctly.
But what I don't know, I kind of vaguely remember Curtis and his flying machine, not Curtis's flying machine. So I don't know if it was him or if it was Ely as the other guy, I think was one of the test pilots.
Well, pretty cool.
So... Good. Sorry for the rabbit hole, folks.
It was fun.
Go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.